My name's Paul Bestall. This is Mysteries and Monsters on the Paranormal UK Radio Network. Welcome back to Mysteries and Monsters. This week, we take an overdue trip back into the paranormal with Canadian investigator Morgan Knudsen. You may have seen Morgan on TV recently as a regular contributor to both Haunted Hospitals and Paranormal 911. We discuss the paranormal in Canada, her family history in the world of the supernatural, Canadian hauntings, and we take a spooky trip around Edmonton's most notable locations, as well as discussing her paranormal shows, belief, and ritual. Morgan is a refreshingly honest investigator, so we had a great chat, which I'm sure you'll enjoy. Before that, I'd just like to say thanks to everyone who's been in touch recently with guest suggestions and kind words about the show. I appreciate anyone who takes the time to drop me a line, so I'd just like to say thank you to Sarah, Steve, Andrea, Claire, Andros, and especially Matt in Australia, who made me very jealous with his picture of himself in the Blue Mountains listening to the show. Keep watching out for those yowies, Matt. Keep leaving those nice reviews for the show. Every one of them helps the show reach new listeners. So if you haven't left one, I'd really appreciate it if you just take 2 minutes of your time to leave one today. Well, I've been super busy this week, tying down 3 new interviews, as well as having the pleasure of being a guest on the Amazing Ghost Story Guys this week, with Ian and Brennan. We dive into ghostly phenomena that occurs on mountains, and the show will be released this week as well. Before we speak to Morgan, don't forget you can donate to the show via PayPal under Mysteries and Monsters. You can follow us on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter, as well as dropping me a line at mysteriesandmonsters@gmail.com too. I hope you're taking care and staying safe out there, and to my wonderful brother and sister-in-law, Dean and Steph, happy anniversary you guys, love you loads. Right. Let's join the marvellous Morgan Knudsen. My guest tonight is Canadian paranormal lecturer, investigator, presenter and author, Morgan Knudsen. With almost 2 decades of paranormal experience under her belt, Morgan has a reputation as a tell-it-as-it-is investigator and has appeared on numerous TV shows, including most recently Haunted Hospitals and Paranormal 911. Morgan, we are delighted to welcome you to Mysteries and Monsters. How are you?
So glad to be here. So this is great, and it's I can't wait to dive into all this.
Well, firstly, thank you, because I've been looking around for really interesting people involved in the paranormal, and as I mentioned in my preamble before we went to the serious part of the show, I'd seen you on a couple of TV shows and been aware of your work. Now, you're one of those people that seemed inexplicably linked to the paranormal, because I was aware that your great-grandfather was one of the key catalysts in the birth of paranormal and spiritualism investigation in Canada over 100 years ago.
Yeah, he was. And what's so impactful to me about all of what Albert Dorn Watson did was the fact that, you know, this guy was an extremely notable physician in Ontario. He was highly respected, even right down to the fact his house is now a historical site. And he really put his career on the line to not only get across that parapsychology was something that needed to be studied, but also came with a message that, you know, we are so connected to non-physical, and that this can be such a great relationship of joy rather than something that is horribly terrifying all the time, which I think a lot of the media kind of wraps into it. So he really put his career on the line to put that out there and ended up publishing two books on it. And yeah, I'm very proud to be related to him.
Absolutely. I think it's one of those aspects, and I think it's probably a subject that probably deserves a bigger focus is the historical aspect to the paranormal in Canada, which in my humble opinion certainly seems to be one of those things that not many people outside of Canada know much about Canadian paranormal investigations.
It's massively true. And what's interesting is that there's so much historical focus put on places like the United Kingdom, the US and things like that. But Canada, for some reason, gets skipped over. And we've had some absolutely incredible studies go on here. We've had one being the famous Philip experiment, and just massive discoveries that have happened. We've got there's a neurologist at the University of Toronto right now that's making massive headway with psi research and dementia. And there's so much that's gone on. So it's gotten just passed over for some reason.
I mean, it is peculiar because I think most people, as you touch on there, if you talk about haunted countries, most people will always come to the UK, with America close behind. And I've always found it really odd because once you dive into the paranormal in Canada, there's a wealth of stories from all across the country. In every state, there are stories going back 200, 300, 400 years.
Easily. And we've got an interesting twist here in Canada as well, because we've got such a predominant First Nations population as well. And so the spirituality and the spirit side of things is very much predominant, especially into the prairies. And, we get an interesting blend of phenomena, both with the cryptozoology side as well as the spirit side when it comes to just very strange topics, things like the Wendigo and things like Sasquatch and stuff like that. So we've got a blend that isn't necessarily present in these other locations.
Yeah, absolutely. And also one of my favorite UFO stories, which is Shag Harbour, which is one of those that I'm amazed more people don't know about that either.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's funny because we've got such a cross section of things that to talk about here. But I've also found that many Canadians aren't really as willing to come forward and talk about their stories either. Even when we're pulling cases and things like that from haunted hospitals and whatnot, oftentimes the cases will come from the States. And so it's interesting. It's almost like the dialogue, in a way, people want to learn about it, but they don't necessarily want that dialogue about it. They're a little bit more reserved here, I think. And that might be a part of it as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting for me, obviously, coming from the UK, because my third biggest territory for downloads is Canada. So clearly there are some people there who enjoy the weird and wonderful.
Definitely.
I mean, as we touched on just after I introduced you in regards to your great-grandfather, and kind of saying you were genetically transposed to ending up in this situation, Morgan, by becoming a paranormal investigator purely by, family ties. But was it something that you kind of graduated towards as you grew older, or as I believe you touched on, you probably had some odd experiences as a child, which probably helped open you up to what the possibility was?
Oh, without a doubt. And it was really funny because I didn't end up knowing about my great-great-grandfather until about 6 years into founding Entity Seeker. So I was well into the beforehand, which was so strange. And it shocked the heck out of me that I was related to anybody in the field, let alone A.D. Watson. But I had experiences when I was really, really young. I was about 9 years old or so, and I had some stuff happen to me that just terrified me. But at the same time, it fascinated the hell out of me. I was just blown away by the things that were going on. Here we're taught all our lives this isn't supposed to be happening, and here it was happening. And so my curiosity absolutely took over, and I thought, this is the real form of magic. This is amazing. And I couldn't let it go.
I mean, yeah, it is interesting because, like I say, I was very interested to hear some of your experiences. So could you expand on them a little more? Because it's not, I think sometimes people, when you say, oh, yeah, I grew up in a haunted house, it's either all or nothing, I think, in some stories, you know, it's all, you know, things are moving around the house and people are disappearing and dolls are turning up in rooms they're not supposed to be, or occasionally something might just move around. So how was yours?
Well, it was interesting. I lived in a few different ones, and most of them in BC, in Surrey, and it was fascinating because the first place that myself and my parents lived in was very interesting, because I think what had happened was that because my focus was becoming more and more into paranormal research even at that age, just looking up documentaries and catching what I could. Of course, sightings was big at that time on TV, and I thought that was just incredible. I watched that frequently. And what was funny about this was that, you know, the more my focus went there, the more I started to attract the phenomenon that was going on, and my entire family was experiencing it. And I think it was my first lesson in understanding that what we focus on, we bring to us. And so my first incidents included everything from, you know, being I had an apparition move right through me on a staircase. I had I was chased, almost chased up the stairs by some sort of an energy that looked like a opaque shape that came rushing at me out of my kitchen. My parents experienced somebody laying in their bed at one point. Absolutely wild stuff. We were renovating this house at the time, and things would go missing. Money would get moved around. There was all sorts of interesting stuff go on. And the house I had after that, when we moved, it was fascinating as well. A lot of residual energy. We had a little ghost dog that would run up and down the hallway all the time, and we'd feel him jump up on the bed. There'd be crying in the basement, and, you know, somebody, of course, we'd all think it was the other family members, so we'd go check on them. There was nobody there. So it was just really a case study in and of itself, and it was unforgettable.
Oh, I always love a good ghost animal story. I have to say, especially a dog one, because I've mentioned this a couple of times to previous guests, Morgan, that I'm surprised we don't have more. So I'm delighted to hear that you've got one.
Well, it's funny because for about 13 years after that little dog, years later, we moved out to Alberta, and we ended up getting a living cat, but the it was this white apparition of another cat, and he was with us for about 13 years. We nicknamed him Horatio, and we'd think we were looking at, you know, our cat or whatever. You'd go to pat him or something like that, and he would disappear. But when our cat passed away, Horatio went with him. So we don't know what connection that was. We never saw him again, but he was with us for 13 years and moved house to house with us as well.
Wow. I mean, that's always an interesting aspect. I think when it comes to hauntings, obviously there are a couple of famous cases where it seems an entity follows a family when they move. But I've never come across that kind of experience when it comes to an animal haunting, and that's fantastic.
Oh, it was so much fun, and it was a blast to have him around, because, you know, you'd be sitting there and all of a sudden you'd see him in pieces. So you'd see like a tail and ears go by, or, you know, you'd see the back end of him go around a corner or something like that. So every once in a while you'd see kind of this piece of him.
Yeah.
But we had a number of people that would come over, and I mean, they thought it was our cat, you know, and they would go over to pat him or something like that, and he'd disappear and would just scare the crap out of them. But I absolutely loved him. He was such a blast to be around. And my I have a python right now, and he's been I've had him for 15 years now, and he would see our cat as well. And that got quite interesting. He'd see him oftentimes before I did. And so he got quite used to having this mysterious cat wandering around the house as well.
Fantastic. I mean, that's very interesting as well, because often when I've discussed hauntings or gone into certain cases, there is usually one of the key indicators that something a bit strange is going on is usually that the animals start acting a bit skittish, or they won't go in certain rooms, or they stare at certain parts of the house where nobody's there. And so for another animal to comprehend and witness a ghostly animal apparition, I think's fantastic.
Oh, it's so cool. And what's been really neat about, especially about Galen, my snake, they Python specifically, they see in a wide spectrum. They see from UV right to infrared. And he picks up on stuff all the time. And I'm pretty positive over the last number of years, we've had a regular visitor that he knows or he knew at one time because he will acknowledge them and want to play with them. So whoever it is that comes and visits, he's well aware of. I never see them, but he is absolutely enthralled with whoever it is. And then they usually leave through an outer wall or something like that because he will watch whoever this is disappear, and then he's looking for them for a few seconds, and then he goes off and plays. But it's quite fascinating to watch him.
I mean, that's a fantastic indicator, and one hell of a ghost alarm as well, I suspect.
I think he is, and when he was seeing the cat originally, it scared him. The first time he saw it freaked him right out. But it wasn't long after that that he realized that everything seemed to be okay, and then it became I think a little bit of a game with him, where it's like, oh, there's that weird cat again. So he'd follow him around or try to instigate play or whatever. But it's so cool to see animals interact with this stuff.
Absolutely. And I've always found in the majority of animal ghost cases that I've read about or spoken to people about, that there seems to be an overriding feeling of comfort or friendliness from these spirit animals wandering around.
Definitely. And interestingly enough, statistically, the majority of people do get comfort from their paranormal experiences. And I think it's a lot of these TV shows and whatnot, they're really throwing the scare factor in, where it gets ratings and it's exciting and whatever. But the majority of people find great comfort with having had some sort of paranormal interaction. So I think it's even more wide space than even just animal encounters.
I mean, to be honest, I think that says a lot. I mean, most TV shows, there is one in particular where they never find ghosts, they're always finding demons.
Well.
I don't know where all the demons in the UK have gone, but we just tend to, find ghosts, usually in pubs, unusually. Which I think says a lot about British hobbies, more than anything else, Morgan. So in Canada, do you tend to have a more UK, I mean, obviously, because you have three cultures, like a giant melting pot. Obviously, you've got the British, the French, and the First Nations. So have you found that Canadian ghosts are traditionally more European in, the way they behave and interact, or do you tend to find that there's a more demonic, evil anger to these?
Oh, it's really funny because the majority of what we find is a lot of peaceful encounters, a lot of fascinating ones, some really magical stuff that goes on. But it all depends on the client and the person that's reporting it, because the one thing that we've noticed over many years of doing this has been the fact that people's emotional state is so derivative of the type of activity that they're attracting. And it's very much related. And so when we've got people that are, sort of typically in the negative end of that emotional spectrum, or they're dealing with something that's bringing them there. The activity very much mirrors what's going on in their environment. So our job as investigators, that's why I developed my Teaching the Living program for clients, because we began to realize very, very early on that once they were able to get themselves into this better state of being and into a better state of mind, the type of activity that they were experiencing would be vastly different or nothing at all. Mm. So our job really was to do that. So it really depends on the people and the clients that you're dealing with day to day.
Yeah. I mean, do you think that most people, when they feel that they require outside help for a situation, do you think that they're predisposed to fear whatever's occurring, rather than, because what I've been impressed with a lot of the aspects of your particular standpoint and the things you talk about is that you come at this in a very positive manner, Morgan, which, you know, as we've touched on briefly, as I've mentioned, certain shows tend to just ramp up the scare factor. Do you think it's more a case of, you know, not that I'm trying to create a term, more of a spiritual education in regards to how you deal with such a scenario?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this really is about, you know, I think bringing people the right information, and the fear of the unknown it's so pervasive. And with the current circumstances that, you know, we're living in just with the world right now, the unknown it can be a really scary thing for people, which is one of the reasons why I'm trying to do daily live streams, because I'm finding that how people are reacting to things like the current coronavirus and stuff like that is very, very similar to how people react to haunting situations. There's nothing for them to point at and go, it's your fault, or you're causing me this problem, or whatever. It's an invisible issue. And usually when people are dealing with something that they can't really put their hands on, it makes you feel helpless. It takes away that sense of security. You don't really know what's going on, very similar to a haunted place. And in order to alleviate some of that, we have to bring the proper information to the table. So for me, educating about the paranormal and getting people okay with not knowing, because we just don't know everything. We can't. So getting okay with not knowing, sitting in that, and then being able to educate yourself going forward is absolutely crucial.
Mm. I think that's just the human nature, though, that for some, everything must have an answer. Whether it doesn't really fit, it's got to have an answer.
Absolutely. And that's oftentimes where things like storytelling comes from. Mm. You know, when we're talking about, you know, a lot of the lore and whatnot that goes around with hauntings, you know, people will put a story to something that they don't necessarily understand, you know, and then of course you get the people that, you know, want to amp up the scare factor and turn it into something, you know, frighteningly entertaining or something like that, which is fine. But I think there comes a point where, you know, we have to be able to take a step back and go, okay, at what point is this entertainment versus what point is this serving people? Mm. And to be able to turn around and allow for, you know, some education about the unknown while still keeping the air of curiosity and mystery.
Mm. Absolutely. And I think for a lot of people that, as you refer to there, the art of storytelling is essentially allowing the traditions from wherever they come from, it really gives people an opportunity to kind of break things down and try and decompartmentalize what they're actually dealing with in a rational manner.
Yeah, and we always, I mean, all of us tell ourselves a story about the things that are happening. And the thing is especially when I'm dealing with a client or something like that, is the danger in that is that we have a tendency to believe ourselves. Mm. And that can be a really good thing in the sense that, you know, if you pick up a chair and you go to sit down on the chair, you believe that you're going to be able to sit on the chair without collapsing. Yes. But at the same time, you know, if you're telling yourself a bad story about something, that's when we tend to get caught up. So part of my work with Teaching the Living is being able to interrupt the story if it's no longer serving the people that are telling it.
Yeah. I mean, do you often find that it's the hardest part of this aspect of it, Morgan, is breaking down this preconceived notion of ghosts as being negative continually, or maybe you could say it's an unconscious bias that we're so used to these days in pop culture. Any kind of spirit interaction is a negative performance.
Yeah, and the problem with it and what I've found is that it's really cutting people off from getting in touch with a deeper part of themselves, just that non-physical part of them, because if spirits are bad and non-physical is bad and all of that's evil, then what do we do with that part of us? So it really starts to disconnect us and sort of focus a little bit more on our own ego and whatnot, and that doesn't help. So being able to get people to turn inwards and go, look, we have to acknowledge this, and then start to realize that our environment and the paranormal activity in it is inexplicably connected to everything that we're thinking, feeling, and being, and get them to understand that there's a connection there. So it can be really difficult when you've got somebody who is hell-bent on the idea that all of this stuff is bad and they've thrown a blanket term on it.
I mean, I've always found it peculiar, to be fair, because I would never claim to be an expert about anything, Morgan, as I'm sure many of my friends will tell you. regardless of what I may or may not think about certain subjects, but I found it interesting. Here we are in the middle of a worldwide health crisis. Now, 100 years ago, spiritualism had a massive boom after the end of the First World War, primarily from people seeking answers and comfort. And it was a very reassuring movement and a very nurturing and loving kind of creation that I think allowed spiritualism to spread again after kind of dropping out of favor for 20, 30 years. To see how it's now become, as we've touched on there, constantly put forward the majority of the time as a negative, dangerous, unwieldy situation to be in or to be amongst. And I've always found it odd that you can't really quite see where that turn of opinion came, but that's, spiritualism was born out of a need for answers more than anything.
Definitely. And I think some of where that turn happened, unfortunately, is with things like some of the medical profession and things like that, when we very much began to split this. And I think it's an erroneous split, honestly, where they began to split between this is either, crazy and people talking about ghosts and goblins and things like that, and then there's science, and the two shall never meet. And I think that was part of the problem, because the people that were very hardcore materialists really wanted all of this concrete, subject matter. They wanted to be able to dig their fingers into something, and if you couldn't, then you were considered crazy. If you can't measure it, then it's not there. And I think that became a deep divide early on, something that my A.D. Watson faced at the time, was the fact that, how can you be a medical professional and still, have an understanding of this stuff? And we still see it today, where we've got people who, I mean, the best universities in the world have parapsychology labs and are studying this, Princeton and Northampton and, Yale and all of these amazing universities, but there still is this underlying tone that you just don't do that. And if you're a scientist, you don't do these things. And if you do, you're crazy. So I think that's part of where that divide started. And what most people don't realize is the Society of Psychical Research, when it first got its feet in the ground, it was actually developed in order to stop things like fake mediums and debunk this kind of thing, so that they could stop that divide from happening.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, it is very interesting when you, as you touch on there, when in the early days of the British society especially, it was a litany, a who's who of some of the greatest minds in England at the time, from all walks of scientific backgrounds and academia, who were kind of attacking this as a new branch of scientific exploration.
Absolutely. And that's the thing, is that the universities today are still doing this. Like Yale just came out recently, within the last little while here, with the COPE experiment, and they're actively looking for people that have had psi experiences and whatnot, because they're trying to establish a new baseline for understanding mental health. So I think everybody's making these massive strides forward, but it seems like the public, for some reason, is kind of they're missing it. And what I would love to see, and what I try to do with some of my shows, is or at least my live shows, is to blend this world of academia and what's going on there with enough entertainment to be able to educate and keep people interested, because no one wants to sit down and read a stack of published papers anymore.
Yeah, well, that is usually the other downside to scientific research into the paranormal is it's occasionally, I think most people would consider it to be what we would know as dry reading.
Definitely. And the public, the public is used to consuming something exciting. They're used to seeing stuff in front of them. They want to see it on film, which is notoriously difficult to do. And we have to be able, as researchers, to come up with ways to present this to the public where they're getting the right information, but in a really a fun, entertaining, and memorable way.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's one of those things as well. I think that's also a pop culture phenomenon as well, that for a lot of people, that they just want the facts as entertainingly and as quickly as possible. Feed me now, thank you. Whereas
Completely.
I think for a lot of aspects of this, really you need to be focusing on it as your introduction, as the starter, and you've got one hell of a main course ahead.
Absolutely. And and getting people excited about the fact that this stuff isn't all it's not all crazy. And I think that's where even some of the entertainment shows right now are they're running into trouble, because we've got to break that mold of even the skeptics that are out there that are looking at these shows and believing that this is what paranormal research is, and that's a problem. So if we can label the shows as they are, as entertainment, and go, yes, it's entertainment, yeah, it's fun, it's tune in for a nice stare, however, it's entertainment in the same way that CSI is entertainment.
Yeah, very much so.
So I think making that definition is important.
Yeah, I mean, it is, as someone who's grown up and their entire life involved in the paranormal, whether I wanted to be or not, Morgan. Despite a brief hiatus, I've only recently kind of embraced my love of the weird properly, and just basically gone to hell with it. I don't care anymore if people think I'm odd. People think I'm odd anyway, so I'm quite happy now to embrace my love of all aspects of the weird and wonderful world, especially of the paranormal. So it's interesting that, like we say, paranormal television compared to, say, ufology and cryptozoology seems to have hasn't really changed much over the last 15 years. The shows are pretty much the same. Team turns up, legendary haunted location, let's find out what happens. Yes, this is it. Whereas the others seem to have pulled away from that kind of entertainment aspect to kind of really go at things scientifically again, which for me is a breath of fresh air. But do you think it's as you mentioned briefly there, skeptics view paranormal television as paranormal research?
And you're right. There's been a divide there, because we have these fascinating documentaries coming out in the world of cryptozoology, and one of my favorites was Bigfoot Files, that was on with Dr. Brian Sykes when he was looking for DNA and whatnot. And I thought that was a brilliant series. I watched it, I don't know how many times. I thought it was just It was expertly done. And you've got places like Oxford that are kind of willing to put that out there and put that on the line. But I think that is it is part of a problem where, if I don't think they know in terms of parapsychology and psi how to expand on that TV show concept, because they've got a formula right now that is, it makes people tune in, and networks are all about, repeating the same thing over and over again until it's done. So, they found a formula that's just working, and it's like, why fix what ain't broke? So we're just going to run with it. But they don't realize that at the same time, they're missing all of these huge chunks of information that are coming out otherwise. There's been a couple of shows, I think, that have tried for that, one being Fringe and the other one being Psi Factor when it was still on. And Psi Factor I loved because they were dealing with the actual cases of Christopher Chacon, and he ran a think tank of paranormal researchers that was extremely well funded. And all of these episodes were based off of true cases, and they were very much cutting edge when it came to what they were doing because they had the funding.
I think what the paranormal needs is a Robert Bigelow. You know what I mean? They need a multimillionaire who loves the paranormal to go, there you are.
And funding is such a big is such a huge thing, and it's difficult for a lot of serious parapsychologists to get because, even still, if people branch outside of their degrees, because usually they're in either psychology or something like that. When they branch outside of their degrees, immediately the universities often will say, well, no, we don't offer funding for that though. We'll give you funding for whatever you're doing for the first degree, but I don't know about this one. So yeah, if there was more money and more funding available, I think we would see leaps and bounds in new discoveries.
Surely there's a multimillionaire out there whose favorite film is Ghostbusters. Surely.
Surely there has to be, right?
I mean, one only has to look back nearly 40 years ago to see the struggles Doctors Venkman, Spengler, and Stantz were having getting funding at that era. So I'm disappointed to
It's
see
right.
that nothing's changed, Morgan.
Well, and the funny thing is too about Ghostbusters is the fact that Dan Aykroyd, like, he's held a chair with the Society of Psychical Research for ages, and part of his effort to get Ghostbusters going was to bring parapsychology and make it a household name for people. So part of his motivation, he used to watch Ghost Chasers, and he would he wanted to put something together that would make people laugh, but would also get people talking about it. And, bam, there was Ghostbusters. But he's had a phenomenal history in living in haunted places and all sorts of things.
I mean, he's one of those people that if you're listening, Dan, I don't think you are, but we've been trying to get you on for ages, and you're always welcome. But I'm astounded because he's one of those people that, unless you dig into his family, you wouldn't know that, because essentially Ghostbusters is basically a biography of his childhood.
Definitely, definitely, and I think the things that were on his wish list too, and his like his the one house that he his the farmhouse, the family farmhouse, has had some incredible encounters with residual energy. He's believed for a while that the house that he's in now is haunted by Mama Cass, and she interacts there regularly. So I mean, there's yeah, I mean, he's just had a extraordinary life with this stuff.
It's fantastic. I mean, in regards to you then, Morgan, obviously you referred to as your experiences as a child. So when did you kind of think, I want to embrace this as a potential profession, and let's see where this adventure takes me?
Well, it was funny because my best friend and I at the time, Stephanie Wirtz, she and I were we literally gave up our childhoods for this. I mean, we didn't go to school dances. We didn't go to any of the. We were. This is what we were doing. This was like we were such nerds. But this was our. thing. And you know, we absolutely had this drive and passion for it. And then we ended up finding a number of other people just through online and whatnot that were very interested in as well. But when things kind of went south with them, they decided they didn't want to work with staff. She was disabled, and there was a whole story behind that. But we ended up realizing, they were like, you know what? We're seeing patterns here in cases, and the places that we were investigating, and the people that we were talking to. And we realized, we're like, wait a minute, like, we're seeing patterns here that other people don't seem to be picking up. And when we began to sort of experiment and implement some of those tactics with people, we started to see results, like powerful results. People were improving their situations.
Welcome to Kraken Mare, the biggest liquid hydrocarbon ocean on Saturn's moon Titan.
And this is just one of the places you get to visit and learn about when you listen to the Hostile Worlds podcast.
The Hostile Worlds podcast, which is, of course, a science-based audio drama documentary series that teaches you all about our universe in a fun and entertaining way.
Head on over to hostileworlds.net to subscribe on your podcast app of choice.
And we thought, you know what, we need to start talking about this. And so, yeah, we kind of, Entity Seeker was kind of born from that. And we continued to just bring in and attract more people in to the cause. And lo and behold, it wasn't long later that we were holding lectures about it, because we wanted to see, you know, who would come out, who would listen. And when we started holding the lectures, we ended up selling out immediately, and it just launched us into a really interesting position. But we never charged for investigations. We never charged for our help. So it was always a matter of, you know what, okay, how do we, you know, how can we support ourselves and what we're doing without charging these people money for our assistance? And so we decided to, you know, start putting on the workshops and educating in that regard.
Yeah, because you are one of those people that I'm incredibly envious of, because you seem to be able to spin about 17 plates at once,
Yeah.
Morgan. So please take that,
True.
please take that as a compliment. Not professional envy.
No, it's bloody true, and sometimes it's not a good thing, but
I mean, it is incredible how certain people, especially in the world of the weird, are able to be presented. They just seem to be able to seamlessly slide into something else. And you're an educator, you're an investigator, you're an author, you're also a performer. Is there anything you've yet to tackle?
I'm a terrible juggler. I'm a terrible juggler. And I'm terrible at math. Math. I'm
Right.
terrible at math. And don't get me to do math.
Okay.
Yeah. But you know, it's funny, because yeah, I think so much of this, though, is really about, there's an art to it. And I've always been massively into the arts. And whether it be drawing or writing or speaking or creating shows, I'm heavily involved with a production company here in Edmonton named called Catalyst. And we are very much, we're really about arts. And I think when it comes to paranormal research and you know, being able to present this material and whatnot, it is, there is an art to it. There's an art to understanding your own state of being. It's all about, you know, looking inwards and being you know, being aware of the self. And so I think it looks like it's a million different things, but I don't think it is really at the end of it. I do a lot of fire performing and things like that, which I bring into my lessons about the paranormal as well. And you know, there's that translates as well. You know, from one to the other. So they're very much interrelated.
Yeah, I mean, I do like the way you frame your firework in your show, because essentially it's all about changing perception.
Absolutely. And you know, when we're so rigid when it comes to our paradigms about certain things. And the fire has been such a great way to show people that, yes, there's truth to, you know, maybe what they're telling themselves or what they've been taught, but there's loopholes. There's loopholes, and it's not always the way they think it is. So being able to, you know, touch fire and eat fire and do all these things can help start to give people a visual to start breaking down their paradigms about what they think, you know, something is or does or the state it's in.
Yeah, very much so. So do you think that's kind of lent to make you seem as a more compelling person to be on TV, Morgan, because you've, you know, over the last two or three years, your profile has increased dramatically in regards to your appearances on Haunted Hospitals and Paranormal 911. So do you think it's that background, and as you've touched on, which, you know, I'm always impressed by anybody who's happy to describe themselves as a nerd. So
yeah.
Do you think that that background allowed you to be more receptive to appearing on television in that kind of format?
Well, I think TV is a great tool, because if, you know, it's a great platform to be able to get information to a vast amount of people. And, you know, we've had, you know, I've had people go, well, you know, oh, you're famous because you're on television, or whatever the comment is. And to me, it is simply that, it's a tool. And, you know, if that's the way that we can get, you know, people to have this discussion and listen, then great. If it was radio, then great. But, you know, I grew up in theater, and, you know, I grew up in, I did street performing for 2 years, and I learned efficiently how to be able to build a crowd, how to keep people's attention, how to make things interesting enough, mm-hmm. because, I mean, people can wander away at any point in time, mm-hmm. And how to deliver information in a way that is fun. Because oftentimes we miss the fun. Mm. So the more we can make this about, you know, like a production, and be able to tell a story through the art of theater, whether it be on television or whether it be, you know, one of my live shows, then I think it's a great vehicle.
Yeah. I mean, have you found it daunting in regards to some of the cases you've had to sort of cover on these shows? Because some of them are pretty freaky.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's amazing the people that come forward. They're so they're really courageous in wanting to come forward and tell their story and be that vulnerable. Mm. So I think for me, I think the daunting part is to make sure that when I get a case, you know, that I'm asking the right questions and being able to tell people's story properly. Mm. That's really my big stickler, is the fact that it's like, okay, what did you experience? You know, I get a stack of pre-interviews and like maps of the location and whatnot. So what I find daunting about it is making sure that I'm giving the best opinion that I can, with the most information and the most accurate opinion as well. Because otherwise I feel like I would be dishonoring that person's vulnerability, coming to me and bringing me something that is, you know, took them a lot of courage to tell. So I've got that responsibility and that duty to give them the best information about that as I can.
Absolutely. I think, and I've spoken a couple of times with some of my previous guests, I'm always, whether or not I'm on side in that, in regards to certain phenomena across a few fields, Morgan, not just the paranormal. I'm one of those people. I'm not going to dismiss anything someone tells me out of hand if they feel brave enough to come forward with essentially what is classed as, in certain circles, hocus pocus.
Yeah. So, yeah, and absolutely.
Oh, go on, after you, my love.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, I think you're spot on. And the thing is, you know, in these cases, perception really is reality. Mm. So how they perceived it is their experience. Mm. So you can hold a space for them without being judgmental or anything like that. It's just sometimes it's just about holding the space for somebody.
Yeah. And for a lot of them, it's actually having the opportunity to speak to somebody that actually believes them.
Oh, it's so healing, mm-hmm. you know, it's so healing. And especially when you've got something that's been frightening or terrifying, or somebody's been, you know, felt violated in some way or something like that, mm-hmm. being able to put words to that and not being rejected, is such a massive point in somebody's healing when it comes to stuff like this.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I've always, like I say, for certain shows, some of these people, they're very personal stories, especially when it's involving a family member that may have passed away, or a situation in a home where there's tension and something seems to gain energy from that kind of negative environment. So I think that's probably the best way you can respect these people and what they're saying to you, Morgan.
Definitely. And, you know, I teach some courses here in Edmonton through some of the post-secondary colleges and universities. And usually I'm teaching psychology or social work students. And, you know, this is one of the things that I really drive home with them when it comes to paranormal stuff, is that, you know, they're going to come into these homes, you know, whether the client is, you know, telling them about something spiritual or is telling them about, you know, something going on with them, is the fact that how they respond to it is going to be so crucial in building that trust with somebody. Mm-hmm. And it's not their job to go in and what they deem as fix the family or, you know, the people that are involved in the situation. It's their job to be able to figure out what their version of happiness is and get them to where they need to be. It's not about inflicting your beliefs on them. It's not about, you know, trying to force them into a box that they don't belong. It's about understanding how to meet people where they are. Mm. And once you can do that and you can figure out where they are, you can, you know, be that compass, but you're never going to be the solution for them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's always difficult as well, because, you know, history is littered with people that have been brave enough to come forward and have been absolutely destroyed in the media, and by alleged professional and academical people on, you know, on national platforms, which, you know, there was one notorious UFO investigator, Philip Klass, who had a particularly vicious streak, shall we say, in regards to dealing with anybody that had seen a UFO. And I think anybody that's brave enough to come forward, especially in this modern era of social media and anything can go viral in an hour, I give these people a great deal of credit, because people, the criticism, Morgan, is often, well, they just want to be famous. And I'm often taken aback by that, because I don't think these people who skeptically look at them in that regard have any idea the ridicule these people get across all platforms these days.
Absolutely. And not only the ridicule, but their own sense of self-doubt as well. Mm-hmm. You know, they're, so many of these people already have that internal struggle going on. You know, what did I experience? You know, they're trying to understand it themselves. You know, they don't necessarily know exactly what's happened, and they're frightened that it might happen again. Mm-hmm. You know, so anybody that's coming out and being able to say, hey, look, this, you know, this happened to me. It's such a powerful, powerful thing to do, you know, but we have a tendency when we don't understand something or we don't want to believe that something like this has happened, we tend to make that person wrong. Mm. And that's just not right at all. You know, we see that with even things like, you know, women lately coming forward, of course, with sexual assault stories, yeah. Sort of the same thing, where it's like we have to make them wrong because we don't want to believe that it's happening. And with the paranormal, it's very similar.
Yeah, very much so. It is difficult. I know, especially in this day and age, a story can go around the world in 24 hours. And it's notable that Australia's most famous poltergeist case, the marvellous Humpty Doo case, which is one of my favourite poltergeist cases from anywhere in the world, that essentially was basically an investigation picking through the remnants of a TV expose that had accused them of faking it and making them all look like absolutely sub-intelligent idiots.
Yeah. And, you know, and it's interesting too that you bring that one up, because another another aspect of this that oftentimes doesn't get talked about is the exploitation that can happen as well. And we saw that with, like, speaking of the Canadian side of things, with the Amherst story, where we've got a situation where, you know, you've got a girl that's come forward. She says she's had this thing happen to them. And immediately, you know, you've got somebody that's swooping in that's either trying to change your story, trying to buy the rights off of you, or, you know, trying to turn you into some sort of this sideshow. And so that's the other danger as well, is, you know, the people that will swoop in, and I see it with clients all the time, you know, where they'll come to me and say, you know, we just went to this group of investigators, or this, you know, wannabe psychic or something like that, and they just took all our money and we need help. And it's brutal, but there's a victimization also that comes along, or can come along, with coming out with any sort of story or anything like that. So it's another thing people have to be prepared for.
Yeah, it's for the grace of God go I think, in a situation like that. And you know, all power to anybody that feels, I mean, to be fair, if you're in a situation where you're asking for help, I suggest you're probably at a point where you don't really care what anybody thinks, to be honest, Morgan.
It's true. And you know, there is so many resources out there for people as well. Brazil has got, they're putting in massive counseling services. And there's universities and whatnot with, like, as I say, with parapsychology labs and experts and things like that, where, you know, all of this is going on. My good friend, Dr. Cal Cooper, he's been doing research out of the University of Northampton for quite a long time about grief and bereavement and the relationship of hope with paranormal research and all of that. So there's definitely things that are out there, but people have really got to do their research.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's very easy to find a bad investigator, I think.
Oh, there's so many hobbyists. And I think some of the problem is that people get into this and they don't realize who the clients come or are going to be. So, for example, like, you know, I often tell people at my shows and things like that, if you're thinking about branching into this, understand that, you know, you're going to get the parents who just lost their child. You're going to get the people who have just moved six times and are house poor and are bankrupt, and are their marriage is falling apart because they're fighting like cats and dogs. Are you ready to deal with it? And it's not a matter of always going in and, you know, oh, I'm going to get, you know, as much evidence as I can that night and leave. It's a lot heavier than that. So I think that's part of the problem, is you've got a lot of people that want to get into this for the scare, and then they don't realize exactly what they're digging themselves into.
Yeah, I think if you can solve a haunting in a day, you're either the world's best investigator or a liar.
Yeah, absolutely. And the funny thing is about that is that, you know, that's the problem, is that a lot of these investigators think that they're going to go in and they're the ones that are going to solve it. And it's just not true. It really is about the people doing their own work, you guiding them to what the state of being that they need to be in. And I mean, any sort of magical fix just simply isn't out there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's something you perhaps touch on in your new show, which is Ritual, which is focusing on the true stories behind several famous films, Morgan, including The Exorcist, The Rite and The Conjuring, three particular stories I'm quite familiar with. So do you find it interesting, because obviously, you know, The Exorcist is one of my favourite films of all time, primarily because it doesn't have the ending people expect it to. It's a very graphic and violent film on several levels, be they physical, spiritual, or sexual. And it's, you know, it's, what, 46 years old, and it still stands up to the test of time. Have you found it interesting that there seems to be two versions of the history of The Exorcist?
Yeah, there was a lot of conflicting reports that have come out. And when I was doing the research for for ritual. That was one of the things I kept running into over and over again was the different conflicting reports. I ended up getting right down to brass tacks with it, where I discovered a fellow by the name of Thomas Allen, and Thomas Allen had acquired the journals from Father Bowdern, and he had the firsthand written accounts of what had happened during the time period where Roland Doe was being exorcised. And so when I was putting together that one bit for ritual, I was really basing a lot of it from that. And because I think it's really the one thing that you can really run with is at least the firsthand encounters, regardless of whether people thought it was real or not. At least the firsthand encounters and that testimony as to the people that were actually present.
Yeah, I mean, it is probably one of those stories that we've got this historical document that essentially gives us a piece by piece breakdown of what seemed to be quite a traumatic experience for everybody involved.
Oh, definitely. And it was, it's unnerving to hear it talked about as well. The Jesuit University ended up, because everybody was just so fascinated with the case, ended up doing a panel on it so that people could come and ask questions and talk about it. And Thomas Allen was there and read from some of those journals. And it was chilling even now to hear back as to, even though it was so many years ago, to hear exactly what had gone on during that time period, and to know that, there are cases still today that mimic it. So it's a fascinating subject matter.
Yeah. What did you think, or what do you think, Morgan, is probably the biggest misconception about The Exorcist?
I think a lot of people don't realize that it was based off of a true story. I think a lot of people are really, they've really gotten hung up on, William Peter Blatty's novel and the Hollywood version of it. But there was things that happened in the actual case that were actually what was more frightening than some of the things in the film. Similar to The Conjuring and things like that. Some of the versions of the film they're just not the, there was more frightening incidents that happened in real life. So, I think that's probably the biggest misconception about it. People don't realize that it happened.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of those things that I just find surprising this day and age. But then again, that probably goes back into people taking bite-sized chunks out of information and taking what they want out of it, Morgan.
I think so. And I mean, it's funny because when I was researching into ritual, because I go into not only the films, but I do a backstory of exorcism and whatnot in different cultures and how it all sort of has culminated to the Western version of what they believe the exorcists or the exorcisms look like. And speaking of misconceptions, probably the film The Rite was the only one that has touched on the fact that the exorcists and especially the Jesuits and whatnot believe that it's not about the words that you're saying, but it's about the energy you bring into the space. And much of exorcisms are actually done in silence. Yeah. And it's always flashy to see the Hollywood side of it, where they're throwing holy water and all of that kind of thing. But there's so much of it that's done in silence, which is interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. I think everybody has that preconceived idea. You're just shouting at people. hours.
Totally. And it just, it's thrilling and it's exciting and it's great film, but it's, man, there was a great book called, it was by Malachi Martin, and now the name's escaped me. Fantastic Hostage to the Devil. That's what it was.
Yeah.
And it's a fascinating book. And of course, Malachi Martin was such a controversial figure. Again, Jesuit exorcist. But the five cases that are featured in Hostage to the Devil, I think for me were so fascinating because he not only talks about the exorcism itself, but he talks about the backstory of each one of these people and how their energetic, their sort of emotional state got them to the point where they were in such a terrible mess. And you can read the story either, I think you can read it clinically and you can read it, or you can read it from the standpoint of, you know, oh my God, this was a paranormal event that happened. But either way, understanding the psychology and the backstory of each individual person and how they get to that point was, to me, it was fascinating. It was really interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I know enough about exorcism. Once again, Morgan, I'm not an expert on anything, but I know enough that whenever I read a report where they go in all whistles and bells and guns blazing, I'm just looking for the salt cellar, because I'm going to take a massive pinch with that story.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It's so true. And with any of this stuff, you know, you have to. You've got to be able to look at a case or realize that, you know, people, you know, are often out, you know, sometimes out for social media gratification or something like that. And they're looking for that recognition in some way. So, I mean, you have to be careful about the information that you're taking in and realizing that not all the information you're getting is necessarily complete either.
I mean, we had a notorious case over here about 15, 20 years ago, and I'll not mention the book, but essentially in the book, they made a series if any of this was true, it would prove that poltergeists exist without a shadow of a doubt, Morgan. And they claimed all this evidence, and they didn't clarify any technical issues at all with their recording equipment or anything. And didn't take a picture of any of the physical evidence at all.
Yeah, it just doesn't add up.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't make sense, especially when you're making, you know, if you've got an extraordinary claim, you really have to have the extraordinary evidence nowadays to go with it. And, you know, in order to make massive change, we need that massive momentum. Mm. So, I mean, when it comes to, you know, bringing a theory or anything like that to the table, we've got the knowledge now. Mm. You know, with a lot of these universities that are doing these studies, that are doing this research, we have the knowledge now to back this stuff up. Mm. So, I mean, at the end of the day, there's not really much of an excuse if you're, you know, you're claiming to be a researcher to not be able to at least pull the information to be able to back up what you're saying.
Absolutely. And for anybody that wants that proof, you wouldn't care who comes forward with it, because, you know, I mean, parapsychology and the paranormal are littered with numerous individuals throughout its history, as we touched on, even, you know, from your great grandfather's time onwards, you know, and the spate of fake mediums and history is notorious, and I'm not sure what Canadian television is like, but British TV went through a phase where you couldn't shift for mediums having their own TV shows.
Yeah, and it's like that here as well. I mean, we've got networks and that's all they air. Mm. So it's one of those things where, you know, you have to go into it with understanding, you know, what a lot of the networks and companies and whatnot are after, you know, understanding that it is a lot of this is about, ratings and, you know, making something that's entertaining for people, which, I mean, as I say, I see nothing wrong with, as long as it's labeled as entertainment.
Yes.
And that line is crossed, because, I mean, like, there's a lot of shows out there that they're a ton of fun to watch, and it's, you know, fun to get a jump scare or something like that. But, you know, it's when they cross a line into saying that, no, this is, you know, oh, this is real. And then we've got a problem with people looking, as I say, at the unknown and looking at the unknown around them now with fear. Yeah. And so we get into a situation, you know, like we're in with, you know, COVID-19 or, you know, different political situations and all of that kind of thing. And we've got people that are looking around going, I don't know this or I don't understand this, so therefore I have to be terrified of it. we've got a problem, because as soon as people are in fear, they stop critically thinking. And when they stop critically thinking, then we've got, you know, upset and panic and all that kind of thing. So we have a responsibility, I think, as both, you know, entertainers, investigators, and, you know, showmen, to be able to sit back and go, okay, what am I presenting to the world right now? What message am I sending? You know, and is it helpful in the long run?
Yeah.
And it's a question I don't think a lot of these people ask themselves. You know, they're just looking for the immediate reaction.
Yeah, and that's always a shame, I suspect. It's, you know, I think sometimes the emotional and turmoil that can spin out of some of these situations is often forgotten in regards to the people who need the help the most, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and I think with, in terms of researchers, just in general, you know, and with, you know, people, you know, going on different platforms and whatnot, and I think we have a bit of a challenge to deviate, you know, bringing proper information and having that dividing line between that and fear mongering, and being able to at least say, you know, yes, this is fun. Yes, this is a scary movie. And by the way, here's the link to the right information. let's add that into the mix as well, rather than just, you know, sort of omitting that side of things.
Yeah, very much so. You've always got to read credits on TV shows very carefully these days.
Oh, you really do. You know, in every arena, and it's. But it's also a really good exercise in getting people to, you know, critically think and whatnot. So, you know, I guess that contrast sort of, you know, can be a good thing.
Yeah, very much so. Now, you're based in Edmonton these days, I believe, Morgan.
I am. Yep.
And I think now I might be wrong here. So, as I say, I'm certainly no expert when it comes to Canadian ghosts. But I think you've got one of those romantic old theatres with a mournful female spirit attached. Is that the Princess Theatre?
It sure is, yeah.
Ah, good. I was trying to think, because I think there's two theatre ghosts in Edmonton, and I didn't want to get my theatre ghosts mixed up, because that could cause all kinds of problems.
there's a few.
So what's that story about? Could you tell us about that, if you don't mind?
Yeah, sure. Princess Theatre is a neat location. It's located on a shopping strip called White Avenue, and it's in an area called Strathcona. And Strathcona was the first established town, really, in Edmonton. It used to not be a part of Edmonton itself. It was its own little thing, but it housed the first train station and the first hotel that was built in the area to bring in prospectors and all sorts of things. So it's really a key area. So the Princess Theater kind of went up as an entertainment center for the people that were staying over in the Strathcona area. And you know, it's a beautiful old theater, but people have reported seeing everything from somebody sitting in the audience. And the, you know, security will think someone's just kind of loitering in the theater, and they'll go out to shoo them away, and they'll find that there's nobody there. They've heard, you know, footsteps and whatnot upstairs where there's been nobody in the building. You know, they've seen somebody, you know, on the upper floor, this, you know, woman on the upper floor. So it's a very active little theater.
Yeah, I've always got a soft spot for these mournful ghosts, because there's always... Often with them, there seems to be a modern interpretation of the story, and I've seen it a couple of times, where the modern version of the story doesn't actually match the reality of the person that actually passed away.
They usually don't.
How do you say that?
Oh, it's true. They usually don't, and they usually have some sort of... it gets quite funny, actually. They usually have some sort of sob story attached to them. It's usually, you know, some sort of lost... sad lover or something like that. And the funny thing is that, you know, you look back at in all of these different cases, and that's really not what we find at all. We find, you know, these human spirits that come in, and they are usually there in visitation. They're popping in and out, you know, at will, And they're usually not there at all because they're, you know, upset or sad. They're just they're either popping in and out, or if you do see one that is looks distraught or something like that, usually it's a different type of phenomenon as a whole. And it's usually something like residual energy where you're getting a replay of an emotional event or something like that that's happened. But the ones that are really intelligent, the ones that are, you know, coming back and forth, I mean, they are usually extremely happy, or they're, you know, trying to push a message across or something like that. But you know, it's funny, the theater and the idea of the dramatic story has always been, I think, a running theme in in
Yes.
a lot of these old theaters.
Oh, absolutely. It's always somebody falling off a ladder, or a jilted lover, or something like that that throws themselves from the wings, I find, often in these
Yes,
tales.
absolutely. Yeah, typical of us artists, but we've got to have some sort of dramatic theme or something like that, because, you know, we can't just we don't we can't have a boring ghost, I think is part of the problem.
I know enough lead singers, Morgan, to know that's absolutely true.
That's totally true.
So, as haunted places in Canada go, how does Edmonton rank in regards to some of its more well-known neighbours?
It's got some fantastic places here. You know, it's funny because a lot of the locations, they don't want anybody to talk about them, which is it's so strange here. But there's some really cool places. There's a location down, actually very close to Princess Theatre, called MKT, and it's the original train station that was in the city, which is now a restaurant. And it's you know, we've had them as clients for, oh my God, it's been ages. We had them as clients before they were MKT. They were known as the Iron Horse, and we helped out the owners there. So that place is fascinating. We've had lots of places up and down that White Ave area that have been interesting. There used to be a nightclub that was just behind the Princess Theatre called the Guilty Martini, and that one was an absolute blast. So I mean, there's a lot going on here. Unfortunately, we're losing a lot of our historical buildings because the city has decided to tear many of them down. But we've had some pretty cool incidents in our river valley. Our river valley is extremely active. We've got a huge, beautiful river valley, and the phenomenon there has been great. We've caught some amazing photos, and it's yeah. There's not. It, there's usually it's a stone's throw away to find someplace that has a story.
Are you doing it? Are you still doing investigations with the public? Because I know you used to do one under the guise of, was it Fireside?
Yeah, Fireside Ghost Experience is a blast, because basically what we do is we have a limo bus that we completely decorate as a cabin, and it's got a fire that kind of runs in the background on the screen. You can hear the fire crackling, and the whole inside is there's blankets and pillows, and we serve s'mores and hot chocolate, and it's so much fun. And we go around to all of like a lot of the different locations that I've investigated over the years, so people can learn about parapsychology, you know, have that, you know, really close-knit environment, because we run it in the fall and winter, and it's an absolute blast. And then I do my walk-in classrooms as well, and so it's very very similar in theme to that. And they've just yeah, they're really great. They get people out there and out from behind a desk, and it's really fun.
I saw a little clip of one of the tours. I was very impressed with the car. I thought, yeah, that's my kind of ghost trip.
Yeah, it's the only way to go. And here, you know, we get so cold,
Yes.
and it's some, you know, nobody wants to be out walking when it's minus, you know, 15, 16 and whatnot. And it's a great way to see more as well. Where, you know, usually with other events, you know, you're kind of stuck to one location, but, you know, it kind of gets us mobile, which is always a good time.
Absolutely. No, it looks fun. It's certainly if you're going to turn up at a haunted location, it beats the usual transit van turning up there, Morgan.
Yeah. Yeah,
Know,
it's all
here we come rolling. All power to you.
Absolutely. It's a great way to go. And I mean, it allows people, access, as I say, to good information. It's tons of fun. We have people coming back year after year after year. And we do one at Christmas as well, which is always great. And and then the live shows that I do, things like Ritual and Belief, and then I've got another one that's going to be coming out this coming year called Phenomena, and they're very much theater centered. I've been doing Ritual at the comic expos. It got really good reviews in Vancouver, and it's those have been a great way for people to access some of this information in a really fun way.
Absolutely fantastic. Well, Morgan, I'd just like to say thank you so much for joining me for this conversation. It's been thoroughly enlightening. Thank you for taking the time out of your day to speak to me.
Oh, this has been great.
Hey, my pleasure. Where can everybody keep up to date with you and follow your work going forwards?
Well, people can find me on entityseeker.ca. That's my main website, and it's always kept up to date with events and new information. And there's videos and all sorts of things on there. You can see some of the live shows. Get tickets to stuff. But of course, right now we're all stuck in the house, and we're not going anywhere. So every day on Facebook Live, at the Entity Seeker official page, I go live every morning at 10 a.m. Mountain Time with Spiritual Health Care, and it's a conglomeration of talking about the paranormal, answering questions, and providing tools that I normally provide to my clients that really help people get through all this crazy that's going on right now. It's a great community, and I'm really proud to be doing it every day. So yeah, it's Spiritual Health Care, and it's on the Facebook page, so facebook.com/entityseeker.
Brilliant. Well, thank you very much. It's like I say, it's been a real pleasure to speak to you. It's been really interesting and fascinating to get your insights on a variety of topics. So thank you once again for your time today. All the best, and you stay safe.
Thank you, you too.